Welcome one, welcome all to episode 2 of Life Without Consequence. This is an audiobook podcast written, narrated, and hosted by me, Davey Francis. If this is your first time here, then I highly suggest you press stop and go listen to the previous episode, or you won't understand anything that's happening here. If you are a returning visitor, then you've already met Parker Luderi and Bench Cave, the main characters of this story. You've already met Nina, Parker's girlfriend, and you've watched the two of them fight. You've gotten a little tour of Las Vegas, and you know how the other half live up in the high-rise towers. You know about the horrific way Mad Mike removed himself from this mortal coil, and you know about the strange device he left behind for Parker and Bench to find. We are currently standing at the mouth of a rabbit hole our main characters will very quickly descend into. Before we get back into the story, I wanted to take an opportunity to thank everybody who listened to episode 1. I particularly want to thank the people who have signed up for the Patreon associated with this podcast. You are the people that are contributing to me turning this thing into an actual book that you can hold in your hands and turn the pages of, which is ultimately what I want to do. I mean, it's a book. It should be a book. In the meantime, for $5, you get access to this podcast 2 weeks before it hits regular podcast feeds. If you want to help me out a little more, for $15, I will consider you one of the producers of this show and novel, and will shout you out each episode. This week, I want to shout out to Hampus, who signed up for that tier. At this point, there's nothing else left to say. Let's get back on with the story. Chapter 5. Parker and Bench. Parker's mother had been an outspoken vegan long before the virus pushed most people into a similar dietary decision. She went to protests, she threw paint at people wearing fur, and forced all of her beliefs onto her son from the moment he was old enough to understand the phrase, "meat is murder." The trouble with Mrs. Luderi was that she was a complete hypocrite. She drank milk and ate cheese, and on the rare occasions that it was available, she would always use butter before the many substitutions on the market. This was local gossip to everyone in the neighborhood, except for Parker himself, who believed every word of his mother's rhetoric. At age 11, Parker, like most children, began to rebel. He was tired of the rules set for him by his overbearing mother, and declared to a group of friends at school that he wanted to eat meat, cheese, and all of the things he would never be allowed to eat at home. The other children looked at him in shock. They were aware of Mrs. Luderi's volatility when it came to the rules she set for Parker. The previous spring, Parker had received a milk bag with his lunch instead of the juice box she had requested. When word of the mistake made it back to his mother, she lost her mind and marched into the school screaming about it to anyone that would listen, eventually being carried out by security. They warned him he'd probably end up grounded for the rest of his life if she caught him, and even if she didn't, stories about friends of cousins of distant cousins were apparently irrefutable evidence that he'd get unimaginably sick from the first time he ate meat. Parker didn't care, though. That weekend at a cookout, he and Benj hatched a clandestine plot for him to break veg that found him encircled by his classmates looking at the most intimidating hamburger any of them had ever seen. Two juicy grilled patties sat between two pieces of bread, smothered in cheese and adorned with all the fixings of a traditional burger. "Eat it, eat it, eat it," the kids quietly chanted, trying their best not to draw any attention while simultaneously bathing Parker in an audible deluge of peer pressure. He looked nervously at Benj, who even before rescinding his desire to speak, was an incredibly expressive child. After receiving an affirming look of encouragement, Parker took the biggest bite he could from the sandwich. After that, everything in Parker's life changed. The sentiment might seem a touch dramatic, but if you ask him, Parker will tell you the bite he took from that burger was like dragging his fingers across the foggy glass of reality itself. He'd never felt so many conflicting emotions at once before. His preteen mind couldn't begin to fathom how something possessed the ability to simultaneously make a person feel so good and so bad all at once. All his life, he'd been programmed by his mother to believe that eating meat was the biggest crime a person could commit against nature. However, as the pleasure centers in his brain exploded, all of his mother's speeches that usually echoed prominently in his mind began to hush. Parker ate every bite, and somehow, the only repercussion was shame. He could barely look his mother in the eye. He had nightmares where the earth literally swallowed him up in retaliation. But the entire time, he just wanted another burger. In the weeks that followed, Parker would trade anything he had on hand with children at school for non-vegan treats. Chocolate, cheese, chicken. He had it all. Until 6 months later, when the virus struck, and all Parker could do was blame himself. He thought the world was suffering because of what he'd done. The following year, Parker's mother was found to be terminally ill, and on her deathbed, Parker sobbed and confessed about the burger and the school lunches. He told her that the virus was because of him. Weakly, she took his hand, squeezed it the best she was able, and in her delirium, absolved him of all of his guilt. "Parker, sweetie, all of the things I said about eating animals were nonsense," she'd said. "Just the kind of things you say to look good at PTA meetings." He'd peered into her eyes quizzically as she drifted off, now washed with mounting confusion surrounding right, wrong, and the complexities of social performance. Needless to say, Parker developed a complicated relationship with food from that day onward. This is why it's hardly surprising that despite what had just taken place, it took barely a minute for Parker to begin digging around in the twisted and mangled wreckage of their fridge, trying to recover the sandwich Rusty had given him the night before. Obviously, he had a lot of questions, but Parker wasn't going to be able to focus on any of them until he had some food inside of him. He followed the threatening directions Rusty had given, and when the little toaster oven dinged to signal it was done cooking, Parker marveled at the sandwich. "Look at it! I think the toaster actually improved on Rusty's work. It's like someone saw a Dave Cho or a Sal Andrews piece in a gallery and thought, I can do better than that. But they were right. And everyone agreed. Everyone being me. You follow?" Parker looked to Benj for a response, but his friend absolutely wasn't listening. Benj was busy. Due to Parker's immediate preoccupation, there hadn't been much talk about what had just happened. It was blatantly obvious the device they assumed was a cell phone was actually something significantly more advanced. It was able to transport their fridge out of the kitchen in the blink of an eye and just as quickly bring it right back. Though, any thought about whether or not it could do the same thing to a person was mired in the detail that, while the device had done something genuinely incredible, it had also completely destroyed the thing it transported. Whether this was a symptom of the transportation process or an environmental factor is what Benj was busy trying to figure out. While Parker prepared a meal, Benj was sat at the table, using the silver attaché case as a disposable litmus strip to gauge danger before they proceeded with human testing. When he had initially opened the app, it was set to Las Vegas 1. Using the drop-down menu, he also saw there was a Las Vegas 2. Number 1 had dramatically proven that it was unsafe, so he moved right on to the next one. The silver case blinked out of existence, exactly like the fridge had. But this time, unlike the refrigerator, the case returned without any damage. Vegas 2 was deemed safe. After Las Vegas, the locations became more exotic. There was a pin for Dallas, Texas, which also passed the danger test, returning the case to the kitchen without a scratch. After that, there was Cleveland, Ohio, which they also tested without incident. But its inclusion intrigued Benj. It was baffling that something so futuristic would have anything to do with a place like Cleveland. Ohio, and the majority of the surrounding region, was now known as the Blackout States. Sometime in the 2020s, a series of earthquakes had detached the region from the national power grid and left it bereft of electricity. Aid could have easily been provided, but the government, being what it was at the time, inexplicably failed to act. With the people making decisions about the crisis not directly affected by it, and ultimately using it as a means to push unrelated agendas, the residents of the Midwest were left without power for nearly a year before arrangements on how to help were reached. By this time, something quite profound had happened. A portion of the citizens who survived the disaster came to the conclusion that the earthquakes themselves had been the words of God, and their consequences were punishment for their use of electricity. There isn't a lot of factual information about what happened during this time. The thing people know for sure is that when assistance finally arrived, the blackout states aggressively refused it in favor of their new dystopia. Benj sent the case, waited a few seconds, and then brought it back. Just like Dallas, it returned undamaged. It was cold, but it hadn't been touched. While Cleveland was intriguing, it was the city that followed on the list that completely took Benj by surprise. He turned the phone to show Parker, distracting him from taking his first bite. "New York?" Parker replied, with eyebrows raised. "No way. Not unless this thing's a time machine, too." Parker and Benj paused, looking at each other and feeling the ripple effects of their new discovery. If teleportation was on the table now, why couldn't time travel also be? The problem there was that if they were wrong, it would, in all probability, kill them both, as New York City had been an irradiated wasteland since the end of World War III in 2045. Similarly to World War II, the use of nukes brought a close to World War III at the cost of hundreds of thousands of lives. Except this time, they were dropped on U.S. soil, and it was almost infinitely more deadly. If they sent the case to modern New York, it would likely return glowing green and leave them both riddled with tumors by midnight. "Not worth it," Parker declared. "What's next?" Benj tapped the screen and displayed North Korea's capital, Pyongyang. Parker rolled his eyes. North Korea was almost as pointless for them to attempt a visit to as New York. At least they knew what terrible things waited for them on the Atlantic coast. North Korea was a total mystery. "Benj, let me know when you've figured out if this thing can teleport people without blowing them up," Parker said apathetically. "Until you know that, all I care about is this." Parker pointed at the sandwich, which sat steaming in front of him, and gave it a look that made Benj feel sincerely uncomfortable. It was passionate, verging on sexual, and clearly not for the purpose of comedy. If Benj could have administered some sort of truth serum to Parker at that moment and queried whether or not he thought about fucking that sandwich, there wasn't a shred of doubt in Benj's mind that Parker would have responded with something to the effect of, "Absolutely!" He'd then continue, producing evidence that the truth serum hadn't even taken effect yet, and explain that he was just so proud of his unholy impulse. He'd been rattling on about that sandwich without barely a deviation since the fridge reappeared. And Benj was sick of it. While Parker stared lecherously at two pieces of bread, pepperjack cheese, and bacon, Benj held up the phone, focused it on the sandwich, and clicked the shutter. It vanished in a way that a person's brain might add the comedic sound of a cartoon soap bubble popping when recalling it from memory. Parker's head spun to look at Benj with such ferocity, it looked as though it might have snapped off. Benj, wearing a satisfied grin, jumped up, pushing the chair away behind him. "Benj, I swear to Christ, if that sandwich comes back exploded, I will feed you to fucking bears!" Parker lunged across the table to grab the device from Benj, who ducked further out of reach, clutching at his chest as he silently pantomimed raucous laughter. Parker looked at him as if flames were about to shoot from his pupils. "Benjamin, do you really want to be the second man to die on this property today?" Benj composed himself, calling for a truce by holding his hands up in submission before tapping the return button and bringing the sandwich back from the North Korean capital of Pyongyang, where he'd sent it. Thankfully for Benj, the sandwich returned to the kitchen unaltered. Except it was now held in the hands of a young Korean girl who, after taking a second to process what had just happened to her, began screaming in a language neither Benj or Parker understood. Never the most delicate in the art of communication, Parker also started to scream, which of course did little to calm the poor girl, who was clearly scared to death and only responded by shouting louder. "Benj, make her go away!" Benj wasn't listening. Amid the escalating cacophony that was filling the kitchen, Benj was having a moment of clarity. The device worked. It could move human beings across vast distances in fractions of seconds. Just moments ago, this child had been in North Korea, nearly 6,000 miles away from Nevada. And now there she was, perched on a kitchen table in their little corner of the world. Life, as they both understood it, had been changed forever. Suddenly realizing the excessive noise level of what was happening, Benj snapped out of his contemplation and poked at the screen. The girl vanished, along with Parker's sandwich. "What the fuck are you doing?" Parker snapped. "She's got my sandwich!" Benj rolled his eyes and tapped at the phone screen again. The girl reappeared, now looking even more bewildered than before. Parker reached out and, in what he almost certainly believed to be a friendly tone of voice, demanded that she hand the sandwich over. In response to his outstretched hand, the girl refused, and hopped down from the table, backing herself into a corner of the kitchen, holding it tightly against her chest. Parker looked at Benj helplessly, as if Benj could somehow solve his problem. Benj shrugged. There was more important things he wanted to focus on.
"Hey, little girl," Parker said delicately. That thing you have, it doesn't belong to you."
The girl snarled at Parker, who tried not to look as exacerbated as he felt. Before anything could escalate further, the tension between them was interrupted by three assertive knocks at the door. It was the kind of unmistakable knock that could only be delivered by a member of law enforcement. Apparently, a universal, with the girl looking just as nervous as Parker and Benj. There were three more knocks, followed by a woman's voice.
"Parker, I don't want to fight with you. Can you please just come to the door?"
It was Nina. Chapter 6. Ji-Yoon. At 10 years old, Ji-Yoon had lived on the streets of Pyongyang for most of her life. Practically blind, she saw the world as though she was looking at it through frosted glass, only able to see shapes and shadows. Thanks partly to her poor eyesight, Ji-Yoon's other senses had become razor sharp, particularly her sense of smell. Stray scents drifting past on the breeze would commonly wake her up as she slept. Despite her disability, Ji-Yoon survived pleasantly enough, and in some cases, even better than the other street children in Pyongyang. They were almost always hungry, though. Everyone was. Hunger had become a real problem in North Korea. Despite managing to steer clear of world conflicts erupting around them, the hermit nation was unable to avoid the virus that was killing livestock worldwide and lacked the infrastructure to attempt disease-free bubbles in which to raise cattle. Raising livestock was only one of several challenges facing North Korea. With the planet's climate now altering at such a rapid pace, crops and harvests became wildly unpredictable from season to season. Starvation had become a significant crisis that affected even those lucky enough to have a roof over their heads. For the people who lived on the streets, every day was a life-or-death struggle. It was one of the colder months, and Ji-Yoon was hurrying through the streets to secure her favorite place to sleep. Many children would sleep on rooftops near the warmth of electrical transformers, where high-voltage injury was an unfortunate risk. Ji-Yoon, however, knew of one particular rooftop that was home to a transformer surrounded by a fence. The fence allowed you to feel the transformer's warmth, but prevented you from getting too close. Another reason Ji-Yoon favored this place was its proximity to a small Buddhist community that was still generous with food despite the nationwide famine. Somehow, this location stayed a closely guarded secret between only a handful of children, who all raced to claim it before one of the others could. The other children all knew Ji-Yoon was differently abled, and more often than not, would leave, letting her have the spot should she arrive to find it already occupied. It was a kind gesture, but it made Ji-Yoon feel awful. When it happened, she couldn't sleep at night out of guilt. This is why she was always in such a hurry to get there before anyone else. In her rush, she took a sharp corner without her usual care and slammed into a tall man, bouncing off of him and falling onto the floor. Ji-Yoon looked up, and it barely took her a second to realize who she had run into. She recognized the particular shade of green the man was wearing and the familiar way he held his posture. She could smell the strong scent of gunpowder mixed with canola oil emanating from his rifle. Ji-Yoon had run headfirst into a couple of KPA soldiers and would likely suffer severe consequences for her carelessness. There had been a growing military presence in the city for weeks now. That many soldiers gathering never meant anything good, and Ji-Yoon had been suspicious of something terrible happening in the near future. The soldier yelled something derogatory at Ji-Yoon before spitting at her, his companion laughing in amusement. She shielded her head with her arms and braced for a beating. However, before the assault could commence, there was an explosion, and the sounds of sirens quickly stole the attention of everyone in the vicinity, particularly the two soldiers.
"Go on,"
the soldier growled at her before delivering a sharp kick to her midsection. The universe had given her a reprieve, and although the soldier made sure that she didn't escape without something to remember him by, it was a stark comparison to what she would have endured otherwise. The smell of smoke was beginning to grow more present, and Ji-Yoon could hear the caterwaul of panicked voices coming from all around her. She was becoming lost in the sensory overload until something stood out through it all. The smell of food. Delicious and savory, like nothing she'd ever smelled before. It was something to focus on while the rest of the world sought to disorient and disarm her. She used it as a beacon. Another explosion boomed nearby, and the acrid fumes surrounding her began to mask the delicious flavor. She couldn't bear the thought of losing it, so Ji-Yoon got low to the floor and followed the scent attentively. She was worried her mind was playing tricks on her, that maybe she'd hit her head after running into the soldier. Or perhaps the strange smell had been a poison weapon, a noxious gas designed by the enemies of Korea to affect its victims' minds. Frustrated, Ji-Yoon crawled into an alleyway and lay her head upon her knees, longing for whatever was causing the unique scent she'd been chasing. She hadn't eaten yet that day, and had been hoping the people at the Buddhist temple would have vegetables to spare on this particular night. She was in no way picky about the food she was given and would eat anything that came in front of her, but she liked vegetables especially. Ji-Yoon began to feel the prickly sensation in her nose that usually preceded tears when her fingertips brushed something sat on the ground beside her. Fumbling it into her hands, she felt crunchy, toasted bread and the smell of pork. A genuine excitement rose from within her, but right as Ji-Yoon was about to take a bite, something changed. A strange sensation that was difficult to describe. All of a sudden, the noises she'd been hearing ceased and were replaced by a low electrical hum. All of the humidity had vanished and was replaced by dry, sterile air. She was no longer in the alleyway. Now she was on some kind of table in a dimly lit room with two men. But they weren't soldiers. Neither of them held themselves with that level of pride. Startled, Ji-Yoon began to shout.
"Daishi gayajima! Daishi gayajima!"
she said, pleading over and over again. One of the men, who was the taller of the two with lighter skin, started to shout. She couldn't understand his words, but noticed he possessed a stressed and panicked tone to his voice. The man waved his hands wildly, while the smaller of the two stood still and composed.
"Niga odichi!"
she shouted. But before she could be given an answer, Ji-Yoon was back in the alleyway, once again surrounded by the smell of smoke. She was confused and felt slightly nauseous. What had just happened to her? Ji-Yoon felt sure she must have somehow been poisoned, but the food was still tight in her hands, and it smelled heavenly against all the competing scents. Ji-Yoon went to take a bite, but as she brought it to her mouth, it happened again. She felt the tingling sensation and found she was back in the cool room with the two men. In a panic, she hopped clumsily onto the floor, backing herself up into the corner of the unfamiliar room. She clutched her prize close to her chest, shouting and baring her teeth, trying her best to seem intimidating. Without warning, she and the tall, thin man were silenced by a loud knocking sound. The kind of knocking she associated with soldiers before raids. Everyone was still until three more knocks boomed, startling all three of them. Then Ji-Yoon heard a woman's voice coming from outside. The two men seemed scared, and Ji-Yoon also felt fearful. The tall man whispered to his friend, who didn't say a word in reply. He looked at her and made some kind of gesture with his hands before leaving the room. That's when the smaller man approached her. He didn't appear threatening, and she could sense his apprehension. He beckoned for her to follow him, and Ji-Yoon clutched at his loose, baggy clothes for fear of getting lost in the strange place. He led her down a claustrophobic stairway, into a small, dark room where the only light seemed to come from a single bulb hanging in the center of the room. The small man still made no sounds, but gestured similarly to the man upstairs. She could make out he was putting his hand to his mouth in what she recognized to mean quiet. Ji-Yoon was scared. What could these men be hiding from? She heard the man upstairs speaking to the woman,
Ji-hoon liked her voice. She couldn't understand any of the words, but she thought the woman sounded kind. The man, on the other hand, sounded like he was lying. Grown-ups often tried to lie to her, and she'd gotten very good at being able to tell when they were doing it. Even in another language, she could pick out the telltale signs of untruths. The man in the basement with her seemed lost in thought, and she wondered if she should run. Maybe the woman upstairs would help her. It was too late, though. Ji-hoon heard a door upstairs close loudly, then the tall man shouting. She concluded that she did not like this man. And despite getting the impression that neither of them meant to hurt her, Ji-hoon regretted not trying to escape to the kind voice of the woman she'd heard upstairs. The smaller, dark-skinned man waved unusually at her, then said words she couldn't understand. And without any warning, Ji-hoon found herself once again back in the alleyway, still holding the source of that delicious smell. She still heard alarms, and there were still people yelling, but Ji-hoon was able to block all of that out as she finally took a bite of the most delicious, wonderful thing she had tasted in her entire life.
Chapter 7. Parker and Benj. Parker could almost feel Nina's eyes glaring at him through the front door. He could feel her annoyed and uncomfortable stance, arms folded, weight shifted slightly onto one side of her hip. He took a deep breath, opened the door, and saw exactly what he'd been imagining. "Hi," he said. He stood awkwardly, using as much of his body as possible to prevent Nina from looking inside of the house, seeing a destroyed fridge, and asking questions. There was nothing even remotely natural about his posture. He just looked guilty. It probably wasn't one of Parker's more positive personality traits, but he was usually an excellent liar. Nina, however, was always able to disarm this particular superpower and cause him to throw out tells left and right. When she looked him dead in the eye and saw his pupils dart in opposite directions, Parker knew she'd know something was going on. Nina examined him, pale as always, and now with the telltale gleam of cold sweat dewed across his skin. The giant bags under his eyes read like rings on a tree stump of alcohol poisoning. They almost let her count exactly how much he'd had to drink the night before. "Wow, looks like you two left us a pretty hefty tab to pick up. My bosses will be thrilled," Nina said with a short-lived, perfunctory smile. "Yeah, well, you know, I'd just been dumped by my girlfriend," Parker replied, trailing off but meeting her eyes again. "You think I broke up with you? You think that was me breaking up with you?" Nina shifted her weight off of her hip, standing up straight now. "You threw me out of your place covered in blood. It seemed pretty definitive." Nina glanced down at his clothes to see that he hadn't changed and was still covered in the same blood. "We've been together for 6 years. You think that's how I'd end things?"
"You looked at me like I was something you'd scrape off your shoe."
"You committed a felony, Parker. I work for the police. How do you expect me to react? I turn a blind eye to so much because I know what life's like down here. But seriously."
"So what? I'm supposed to live in poverty because of how it might make you look?" Parker interrupted, unsure why he was escalating things when all he needed her to do was leave.
"Can I come inside? If we're going to fight, I don't want to fight out here."
He didn't want to fight. He hated it when they were at odds with each other. On any other day, he'd be perfectly happy to invite her in and sit quietly while she told him all about what an irresponsible man-child he was. Any other day but today. Somewhere in the middle of hunger, his hangover, and fear of making everything else worse, Parker panicked. "Inside? Inside the house, this house." If selling liquor to Rusty had been such a big deal, Parker didn't want to think about how she'd react to the teleportation device that destroyed the fridge and the North Korean child they'd accidentally kidnapped. "Yes, Parker, this house. Your house."
"Now's not a good time," he said. Nina rolled her eyes. "It's never a good time, is it? Because it's always about you. When will it be about us, Parker? Is whatever you and Benj are doing in there more important than you and me?"
Parker didn't know what to say. Or rather, he did. But he couldn't help listening to the selfish part of him that thought, in the grand scheme of things, yes, it was more important. The device in the kitchen the thing that could transport a person across the world in a second, was infinitely more important than another textbook Parker and Nina fight. That thing had the power to change their entire lives. He could explain everything later, and then this squabble wouldn't even matter. Once he and Benj knew how it worked, he could tell her everything. He'd bypass the shitty doorman in the lobby of her building and appear in her apartment, literally out of thin air, with peace offerings of champagne and roses. Everything in all of their lives would be fine. Right now, though, Parker decided she wouldn't understand. Yes, Nina, what's happening inside is way more important than us. He wanted to say something that would hurt. Something that would make her so angry she'd just leave. Nina's mouth hung open, and tears immediately welled up in her eyes. Usually, he didn't have any trouble being manipulative, but seeing that look on her face nearly broke him. She stammered. This was a mistake. Nina turned and walked to her car, stumbling slightly to avoid the crimson stain in the middle of the path. After he watched her car disappear down the street, Parker walked inside the house, slamming the door behind him. Fuck! He barked. Benj was sat at the kitchen table, holding the device and looking inappropriately excited. Parker let out a long, exhausted breath. Where's the kid? He asked. Benj shrugged. It wasn't callous. The kid just wasn't an issue anymore, and he could tell Parker didn't need the details. You let her have my sandwich, huh? Parker said with a mirthless smile. Before Benj could try and apologize, Parker waved his hand dismissively. Forget about it. I'm not hungry anymore. That kid looked like she needed it more than me anyway. He paused for a second, contemplatively. So, we have a teleporter? He queried. Benj nodded with cautious enthusiasm. Well, I guess we better do some teleporting then.
Artwork for Life Without Consequence was provided by Daniel Sewell. You can find him on Twitter at WriterDanSewell. That's DanSoule. Music for this episode was provided by me, Davey Francis. You can find more of my music at DaveyFrancis.com.